Recently, I began to watch a video given by a well-known chastity expert, somebody very high up in the chastity ministry. You probably know who he is if you know anything about chastity ministry, if you're involved in such programs in your parish or diocese, if you are a young parent, let's say parent of teens, if your children are involved in things that go on in the diocese or even in doing sacramental preparation for confirmation, let's say. It doesn't really matter who this person is. As I talk, I think you may recognize who he is if you already know him. If you don't, it's not a big deal, because actually there are a lot of people out there. It is a business to be in chastity ministry, and there are many practitioners. Anyway, I'm watching this video, and right away the person begins his talk. I see that he is introduced by a priest, and the talk is taking place in a church. And in this church, the priest is standing at the ambo, but the person giving the talk is actually standing in the sanctuary, and behind him is the tabernacle. And I become aware that the tabernacle does contain the real presence of our Lord Jesus Christ, because the tabernacle lamp is lit. So, knowing that he is going to be speaking to quite what seems like quite a large audience, and seeing him, you know, dress pretty casually and picking up a microphone and being in the sanctuary, as I say, I start to be a little bit nervous, and I become increasingly more nervous because he immediately begins to speak in that very popular, fun, hip way that speakers have when they're very popular, of very weighty and dark topics like porn and sexual sin. And as he's talking, I'm cringing. And to tell you the truth, I'm really, from the get-go, just upset because he is giving this talk in front of the Blessed Sacrament. So right there, I have a big problem, but I'm trying to keep an open mind. He is making some valid points that have to be made when we're speaking about chastity, but his whole mode is that of really a comedian, a sort of stand-up comic. He's trying to engage the audience. He's trying to go for laughs. At one point, he pulls out a Barbie doll, which he describes, and which we can see is, I'll call her Fishnet Barbie, if that gives you the idea of what she looks like. And he's waving Fishnet Barbie in front of the tabernacle. I mean, his back is to the tabernacle, but there they are in the sanctuary, him and Fishnet Barbie. And he's telling all sorts of anecdotes about his own experience as a child, being introduced to porn, and honestly treating it lightly, treating it as if it is normal, which I understand for many children today, it is normal. However, he's speaking of it as if his experience was normal and he's treating it lightly. And, you know, it's kind of a funny anecdote about what happened when he became introduced to porn at the age of 9. More concerningly, this person who is hired by dioceses and parishes and Catholic schools to give talks begins telling anecdotes of children who come up to him after his talks to speak privately. He emphasizes that they want to talk to him privately. And at one point he says that the child, sounded like a pretty young child, wanted to be even more private. And he said, well, so going into a dark corner, he literally used the word dark, going into a dark corner, you know, I found out what it was that the child wanted to ask me. Well, okay, maybe this is all being told as a joke, in which case he's not telling the truth, or it is true, in which case there is something seriously wrong, because I think by now, in this day and age, having lived through a cataclysmic episode of sexual abuse in our church, we realize that there are boundaries and that adults cannot overstep those boundaries with children. And one of those boundaries is taking a child who is not your own child into a quote unquote dark corner to find out what he wants to tell you about sex. All of this, let's remember, is taking place in the sanctuary of a Catholic church. He uses terms like sexual favors. He talks about NFP. I was extremely shaken by this display. I want to say at the outset that I have no doubt that this person and many other people who are involved in this so-called ministry do have good intentions. What I'm going to talk about in this talk is how those good intentions have gone awry and how they are objectively leading people into error. And most importantly, they do constitute what I regard, and I'm not going to mince words, as abuse of children, an abuse of their innocence, and a betrayal of the parents. Welcome to the Home Truths Good Cheer Society. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Gospel of John, chapter 16, verse 33. For those who don't know me, I'm Lila Marie Lawler, Auntie Lila. I'm the self-appointed collective memory curator. I write about competence, learning some skills of homemaking, and why we should do all those things on my blog, Like Mother, Like Daughter, and in my books, including the Summa Domestica, Order and Wonder in Family Life, which is a 3-volume box set. Available at Sophia Institute Press. I'm all about the restoration of home in brightness, warmth, and joy. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 4, we read, "Let there be no filthiness, nor silly talk, nor levity, which are not fitting, but instead let there be thanksgiving." It's taken me a long time to get around to doing this podcast. I just am not exactly sure how to organize it. This particular episode that I was talking about, of having come across this video, shook me, and I wanted to talk about it. I wanted to maybe write about it. I at least wanted to do a podcast about it. And I was getting bogged down because I was having trouble just knowing how I was going to organize the talk, because this goes so far deep down into our humanity and who we are and the nuptial meaning of the body of man and woman. And then it just explodes out from there into the parental roles, education of children, our situation today, the attempts that some people are making to address the situation that we are in, and then the resistance to seeing some truths about what that form is taking and how I believe that it is going in the wrong direction. So I just thought that I basically over the weeks I had been jotting down some notes, and I'm just gonna kind of go through my notes because I really don't know how else to approach this. And I figure in the form of a podcast, we can just chat about it. I'm just gonna go through my notes and just talk to you about some of these things that are a little hard in our time to get a grip on, simply because of how far we've come in talking about these things and how we have lost the collective memory. One thing I want to start at the outset is just talking about how in this area in particular of sexuality, there is a lot of jargon, and you could almost call them terms of art, because I do call them that because there is a profession, and the profession being chastity speaker or chastity expert. So there are terms of art that are used, and these words that are used can be construed differently by those who are in the sphere and out of the sphere, which is kind of the definition of jargon. I mean, sometimes jargon that's used in a certain profession just simply cannot be understood by people outside of it. And sometimes the terms are just understood wrongly. So let's just make sure that we are actually on the same page with these terms. So the first term that I would like to discuss just is chastity. What do we mean by chastity? So I think the most important thing to do is to take our definition back to an important traditional source, which would be Thomas Aquinas, and to just quickly read in the Summa, where he says that chastity takes its name from the fact that reason chastises, quote unquote, concupiscence, which like a child needs curbing. The essence of human virtue consists in being something moderated by reason. So therefore, chastity is a virtue. So that means that we have a natural tendency in our appetites to tend to be undisciplined in all our appetites, and especially in something so close to our being as our sexual appetite. And that tendency needs to be curbed by reason. It doesn't need to be eliminated. It doesn't need to be excised. It just needs to be, using an old-fashioned term, chastised, or simply brought under discipline by reason. And that is the definition of a virtue, that reason moderates what we do as human beings. So chastity is a virtue. It's the virtue of having self-control. And Thomas goes on to say, it belongs to chastity that a man make moderate use of bodily members in accordance with the judgment of his reason and the choice of his will. So when we're talking about educating our children in chastity, we can see that by that definition, there are many, many, let's call them remote ways to prepare for helping the child to ultimately have control and self-control over the sexual appetite. And the first remote preparation will be just our own marriage. So the fact that we, husband and wife, have chastised, so to speak, brought under control their own appetites by pledging their lifelong fidelity to each other, to having to hold for each other, just the fact of marriage gives to the child an education already in chastity. And it goes on from there, all the different ways that we ask and demand that our children from the, you know, very small, young age, learn to control their little appetites. Don't rush over there. Don't grab that. Don't stuff that in your mouth. We're ultimately getting to the point where they will learn chastity. Now, in our current way of looking at things, chastity is actually not all of that. It's actually just a jargony term that means teaching children about sex. It means sex education, and I'm going to talk about that as our talk goes along. Chastity ministry means certain people, whether self-appointed or whether somehow hired by the clergy or the clergy's administrative arm, you know, some layperson in the chancery or in the parish, looks through a catalog of speakers, or a guide, if they're hiring somebody, and they will choose a person who is a so-called expert. Maybe this person has a degree in theology. Maybe they have studied moral theology. Maybe they have particularly studied chastity in this very limited sense of sex education with a religious overtone or in a religious context, which, again, I'd like to remind everyone is different from chastity as a virtue, which is not super specific that way. And another term is theology of the body, or often abbreviated, you'll see in social media, abbreviated as TOB, theology of the body, which is something that originated with John Paul II, Pope John Paul II, and was his very sober, very formal inquiry into scripture and personalist philosophy to examine the nature of man and to inquire into what it means to be a man and to be a woman, to have been formed in the image of God, male and female, and the ways in which the human person is a sexual being, in that each one of us is male or female to the roots of our very being, having been created by God to be this way. And his theology on this topic is very detailed. It is not easy to read, and it has been highly popularized and wrenched into the popular world with its own jargon and often with a lot of deformation. So I'm just going to throw that out there. What I find is that theology of the body, spoken of popularly and promoted by popular speakers, often ends up being quite vulgar. And it ends up being almost an excuse for people to talk graphically about sex, even in mixed company, which certainly is not the way that it is put forth in the writings of John Paul II. And this is just a problem in that although the theology that John Paul is explicating is very grounded in tradition and in scripture, it is used as almost a talisman or a sort of trump card to play when people object to what has devolved into chastity ministry. They pull it out and they say, well, it's theology of the body, and that is like so clearly and obviously something that can be justified and rationalized by scripture and tradition, so how can you object? Well, I do object, and I'm going to give you some objections. So let's go over some of the things that people say to justify and defend chastity ministry. they say, first and foremost, they become very defensive and they say, you don't understand the people who are doing chastity ministry, the chastity ministers are good people who have the good of young people at heart. And they may even say, I am a minister in chastity. I am somebody who gives these talks and I am a good person. And I do not doubt that the person saying this is a good person and does have the goodness of young people at heart. And I am not judging them. I am simply trying to demonstrate and refute the assumptions. I'm talking here about ideas. I'm not talking about the character of the people who do it. Although I will say, if you find yourself in front of the Blessed Sacrament, waving around a fishnet Barbie, you need to ask yourself if you are as good as you thought you were. And I say this as someone who has done really stupid and foolish and vulgar things. And all I can say is that as embarrassed and ashamed as I am to think of those things, I think, and as hard as it would have been for somebody to say it to me, I think eventually and ultimately, at least I hope, I would be grateful that they had said something to me. The other thing that people say is that, yes, Auntie Lila, you know, those things are not good. Those things are vulgar, but chastity education is very important and good if done by holy, good, faith-filled people, and it is effective. So I do question the effectiveness part, and we'll get to that, but also I have to question this whole idea that somehow we're going to be able to ensure that the people speaking to our children are holy, good, and faith-filled. How are we going to ensure that? This is a really big problem. It's not enough just to say, oh, well, we'll just find holy, good, and faithful people. Because I think that if we are at all aware, we know that the world is filled of the opposite. Not even that people are necessarily evil and have no faith, but just that they are clueless and are willing to parrot things that they might have heard experts say. They might not be that smart. They may not be that delicate, and they may themselves not have mastered the virtue of chastity. So we have to question the cheerful assurance that we are going to find holy, good, and faithful people to speak to our children who have been given to us as our responsibility about matters concerning sex, which are very important and deep matters. So one thing about these holy, good, and faith-filled people who are only have the good of children at heart is they do not quite understand that they are parroting certain talking points that originate, and I hate to say this because it's going to come as a shock to many of them, these talking points originate with Planned Parenthood. They originate with Margaret Sanger, Planned Parenthood, and the whole movement to bring sex education into the schools. The people of Planned Parenthood long ago, not recently, decades and decades and even a half a century and more ago, decided for themselves that it is up to them to inject their understanding of sex into our children. And they came up with certain almost unassailable talking points. And unfortunately, these talking points have weaseled their way into everyday discourse. And they are things that are now used, repeated, bandied about by, you know, I hate to say it, but like by good Catholics, by good Christians. So what are these talking points? One is, well, who will do it? And the implication is certainly not the parents. And also notice they just say it. They don't really define it. What is it? They say, if we don't teach them, they, the children, will learn from the world. When I was young, and believe me, I'm not young now, so this has been going on for a long time. They would say, children will learn about sex on the street corner. And that definitely created a lot of fear in parents to think, you know, immediately there's the image of who is hanging out on the street corner, like older kids, older teens, thugs, bad people are going to be telling our children about sex instead of, well, then the parents thought to themselves, well, I don't want to tell them about sex. That's, you know, too embarrassing. So yes, let me turn it over to the experts. So that proved to be a very effective talking point. Another talking point, which comes up a lot, and believe me, I post about this a lot, and I always get these exact phrases. I am actually taking them from comments that have been left on posts of mine, on various platforms. I'm not making these things up, and I will tell you these things are things that you will hear in any school board that I heard long ago when I went to the school board, when I went to meetings about whether or not whether or not sex education should be in my children's schools. And these are the things that people said then and they're saying now. For instance, plenty of parents have no idea how to teach either sex education or, when speaking to Catholics, chastity and even theology of the body to their kids. And another talking point is children don't learn sex education. They're not educated about sexual matters. Or if talking to Catholics, they don't acquire the virtue of chastity because they are not taught it early enough. So one very important point for those who are, you know, on the one level, very much in favor of sex education, and then when it trickles down to Catholics, very much in favor of chastity education, is that it must always be taught to younger and younger children. So those are the talking points. So, there's another one, another very important sort of thought-ending sentence that comes out when you say that it is the parent's responsibility. The person will say, well, maybe your children will be taught because you are aware, and I'm all for that, but what about the many children who will not learn because their parents are, insert here, irresponsible, ignorant, what have you. And then the final last thing that's trotted out is, but these programs help so many people. And they might even have anecdotes to bring out about how helpful these programs are. These are the tropes established by the purveyors of sex educational materials and programs, and unfortunately are embedded in the chastity education, chastity professional expert penumbra. So let's talk about them. If we don't teach them, they will learn from the world or, very scarily, the street corner, or who will teach them. So it's true. Children do hear things and learn things from unsavory places and from unsavory characters. That has always been true, and it always will be true because, you know, on the one hand, we do want to protect our children and we'll do our best. On the other hand, you're in the car, you're driving down the road, and there's a billboard, and you certainly can't put curtains on your car. I mean, they'll look at the billboard, they see a magazine on somebody's coffee table, even, you know, because our culture is so pornified. I'm not even saying that it's going to be Playboy, it's just going to be some quote unquote normal magazine, and it will have something in it that is just so, an image that is just so vulgar or even, you know, pornified. And yes, they do see that. They do learn things. They hear things. Unfortunately, you know, some children really have been exposed to things very early on, and they will say things to our children, no matter how hard we try to protect them. Or children just get older, and then they might be in high school, they might be on a sports team. This happens. So one very important thing to know and to understand and to internalize, and this is what I'm talking about with this whole thing of chastity ministry, is that the medium is the message. So the child knows when somebody says something unsavory, when somebody gives them the quote-unquote facts of life, but in a way that we wish that hadn't been given to them, the child not only is taking the little bit of information, he's also taking the context in which the information was given to him. And he knows that the context is not a good one. And that in itself is information for him. So the parent who is, you know, frightened by thinking, oh, he's going to learn all these things in all these terrible places, needs to also know that the child is learning things from the parents, and he's also learning the context from the parents. And the context is what is guiding him to know whether the things are for his good or to his detriment. And that knowledge is what carries him through. So as to the little trope of plenty of parents have no idea how to teach chastity and theology of the body to their kids, well, this is just an assertion. You have to note the jargon. Like, you just don't have any idea because you did not go to get your master's in theology. You are not a chastity expert, TM. You have not done your dissertation on theology of the body. Well, if we had John Paul II here in the room, he would look at us and he would say in his deep Polish voice, but you are married, and this is the theology of the body. Right. He taught that the body has a nuptial meaning. Nuptial means marriage. Marriage is the embodiment of the theology of the body. Parents, by their grace of the state of marriage, know how to teach chastity to their own children. It is true, they would not be qualified to stand up and teach a group of children about these things, but my assertion is that they would have no place in doing that, and neither do you. But they do have, each parent has the grace of state to teach his own child. First of all, the sacramental grace of marriage. The Catholic marriage gives sacramental grace for educating the children, including in everything that pertains to life and sexuality. But even the natural state of marriage, even the fact of being the parent of this child, gives an actual grace. And we need to be very clear about that to those who would like to assert their expertise. Children don't acquire the virtue of chastity because they're not taught it early enough. It's not true that overt and technical sex education must start ever earlier. That is completely wrong. In fact, as I indicated at the beginning of the podcast, the child is learning self-control from a very young age in a remote way by all the little things that he's taught in the context of family life. And all of those things will lead him, when he's older, to understand that there needs to be self-control in this area as well. There, long ago, there was a wonderful little article in I think it was in Crisis Magazine when it was an actual magazine long, long ago, decades and decades ago. And it was written by a rabbi. Might have been First Things. And the title of it, I think I do write about this in my book. The title of it was, Is Chicken Soup Contraceptive? And it was a short article. And all he was basically saying was, why is it that Jewish girls don't, as a rule, get pregnant out of wedlock? Is it that chicken soup is contraceptive? And I mean, this is his little joke. And he said, no, but what it is that because the observant Jew is kosher, keeps kosher, that means that from a very early age, the child running up to the parent with a piece of candy or a cookie or something someone has given him, the provenance of which is unknown, the question that he will be asked by the parent, by the Jewish parent, is it kosher? And I've witnessed this because I lived in a town that was very heavily Orthodox Jewish, and I was on the beach and I watched dads say to their kids, is it kosher? And when the kid would say, like, well, I want to eat this piece of candy, so whatever, the dad would say, how do you know? Who told you it's kosher? They didn't just take yes for an answer. So what the rabbi was arguing was that the child who has self-control over that piece of candy will later on be able to have self-control over his body and will be able to offer the gift of self in marriage. It is a training that's given by the parents, supported by their religion. It is very wrong to give education of any sort that is not in keeping with the stage of the development of the child. So you can't really expect, and you would be wrong to punish a child, let's say a two-year-old, for grabbing a cookie and sticking it in his mouth. Whereas if you saw a nine-year-old doing that, you could be much stricter. We do things according to the development of the child. So the people who rationalize or defend their assertion that they or some other expert can introduce our child to matters of sexuality at whatever age they choose to, and at a very young age, often because it's better for them to learn younger, they are wrong, and they need to be resisted. They are harming. You harm a child when you force him into something that is not in keeping with his development. But these programs help so many. Well, this goes to a principle in economics called the unknown unknowns. There are a lot of things that you just don't know, and you actually can't measure. There's not really a way for you to know. So, for instance, it's easy to say, I gave a talk and X number of people liked it. I gave a talk about chastity, and I talked about porn, and I was talking to 10-year-olds about porn and homosexual acts and sex out of wedlock and abortion. And later, two people came to me and said, you really changed my life. Okay, well, you have now been able to quantify those two people. We don't know what happens to those people later. We don't have a full picture. But it is something that an expert could point to. But it is hard or impossible to say, well, X number of people actually hated this talk or were deeply disturbed by it or were introduced to some idea that they had never had before, who were turned away by the frivolity or the otherwise inappropriate tone, who, because of this knowledge, fell into sin, or who had their innocence destroyed. it's also hard or impossible to say that there is X number of people who never came, who never even considered that they would be exposed to such a thing, that they would expose their children to such a thing. The experts in this field do not have any knowledge about those people. So when they say, well, our programs help so many, it's important for us to understand that that statement is very limited. We can say it this way, that a few people saying they were helped by such and such talk about chastity, as my friend says, this proves nothing about the efficacy of that talk. It makes more sense that bringing such talks to a general audience is a bad idea insofar as it introduces ideas to kids who otherwise would not have had those thoughts, and it lowers the bar when a so-called chassis educator says, hey, I used to do these bad, immoral things, but I repented, and now I have an awesome married life. No harm done. And the other thing is that, as my friend says, it lowers the natural barriers between peers discussing these topics, which arguably raises barriers to discussing this very same topics with parents, who, of course, are the ones who should be the primary educators. So I think these are good points, because when adults who are coming basically with the stamp of approval of the church are speaking in a very familiar and informal way to children about sex, it ends up being that raises the level of informality and even vulgarity and makes it so that there will just be more talk about sex. And that goes against chastity. Chastity is about not bandying about very delicate and intimate matters. That's a very important thing to understand about chastity. Somewhere St. Thomas says that the person who speaks about chastity falls very easily into unchastity. And all of that vulgarity and easy talk makes it so that the children will be even less likely to talk to their parents, because all of this talk about how difficult it is for parents to talk to their children about sex really points to the very important and actually good aspect of all of this, which is that parents don't want to talk about these things too much because they are intimate and deep and beautiful matters. And the parents, in their experience of being parents, have learned that something is really lost when you talk about them too much. And the truth is that it only takes a very short amount of time to give the actual facts of life to the child. You can really get the job done in 15 minutes when you see that the moment has come. And I talk about this in my book. I have chapters about this, and I don't really have time to go into that too much here. But I think we should realize that this is not a 12-year or 18-year curriculum. This is something that is a very small amount of actual factual knowledge contained within a very large and vast life that is lived together. And that is what should not be interfered with. Yes, there will be children whose parents do not teach them. And that is why in the tradition of the church, there are adults, normally the clergy and religious and teachers who really are the children's teachers, not experts who pop in for a talk and then leave, teach catechesis and in a very limited way, relying on time-tested means in terms of the moral law, in terms of the whole of the Decalogue, and also relying very heavily on a concept that we have just about lost, which is conscience. conscience will alert a person who is going wrong, even a child. A child actually has a very delicate conscience. If a child thinks he's doing something wrong, it arrests him in his tracks. He can almost not function. If you see a child and you're just like, what is wrong with my child? Why can he not handle anything about life right now? You might just delicately try to ask if something is bothering him, because very often, unlike adults, when a child has a sense he's done something wrong, said something wrong, hurt someone, he's pretty much paralyzed. If others are willing to state moral principles, the conscience will be aroused. So if we say, for instance, it's wrong to kill the innocent, which is the fifth commandment, then a person who has done harm to anyone will begin to feel the pricks of conscience. We don't actually need to go too deep into any of the things. With children, we just need to state the moral law and discuss it, yes, but in a very limited and self-controlled way. We have lost faith that God made us to want the good, so we don't say and model the good. And then we turn around and complain that no one knows it and no one will teach it, and that parents have dropped their responsibilities, and so we have to step in. Well, let's state some principles. Let's begin with what the sexes are for. God made man and woman. He made them male and female for the purpose of marriage. And marriage is for the purpose of procreation. The two become one flesh, which is their unity, so that they might have children. The church teaches us that God gives parents the grace to educate their own children. The more essential to the core of the human person the subject matter, the more the parents are in charge, and the less the duty to educate can be delegated. We have been conditioned to turn to experts for every problem, and we don't realize that the concept of sex education as a separate indispensable subject is shockingly unexamined and shockingly new. I wrote in my article about sex education for Crisis Magazine, I'll put this in the show notes, that Pius XI stated in his encyclical to the German people, the one encyclical to that point ever written in the vernacular in German, right before the start of the war, and the encyclical is called Mit Brennender Sorge, none can free you, parents, from the responsibility God has placed on you over your children. None can answer for you to the eternal judge when he will ask, where are those I confided to you? May every one of you be able to answer, of them whom thou hast given me, I have not lost any one. And that reference is to the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 18, Jesus says, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. So when someone says to me, oh, well, I mean, maybe it's true that some children are exposed to ideas that they might not have had, and they might thereby lose their innocence. But the important thing is all the children who are so terribly exposed that we bring them the information that they need. But that is not what the gospel says. And believe me, I am aware. I am probably more aware than most of what is out there and what children are exposed to. And I am not in the dark about that. But this is a very serious admonition of our Lord's to us, that we may not take the responsibility for deliberately causing a child to lose his innocence. And this has really, this whole very dire pulling down of the traditional ways of raising children and teaching children, the pulling down of marriage, the destruction of our confidence in marriage, the undermining of our acknowledgement of the parental rights and responsibilities has caused a serious problem in the church of young people leaving the church. And one thing that I just cannot believe is when people who are promoting chastity education say that it's so necessary to keep children in the church, because the truth is we have now had a couple of generations of this and we are losing young people. You know, if you follow me at all, you know I don't often quote Bishop Barron. I don't find him very willing to take a stand for unpopular opinions, even though he does have a reputation as being very conservative. But just to show that I'm not in my bubble, let me share this statistic he posted not too long ago. An average of 6.5 people, Bishop Barron writes, leave the Catholic Church for everyone that joins, and 50% of young people who were raised Catholic are no longer Catholic today. 50%. And he says, the church, the Catholic Church, is hemorrhaging young people. I happen to know that these statistics that he's quoting were based on a Pew Research poll and are just simply incontrovertible. And anybody who says otherwise what can I say? They're just in denial. And just because they know a few people who came into the church as a result of some charismatic speaker does not mean anything about the larger tendency, which is for young people to leave. And I believe that the reason that they leave is a general disintegration of the transcendent in terms of the large picture of who we are as a church, and then also very much the microcosm of the family. The transcendence of the family has been undermined, and the family is sexual in the broad sense in nature. The family is about man and woman. The church is about what St. Paul calls the mystery, the nuptial mystery of God being being the spouse of his bride, the church. So we do have to kind of confront this, that maybe our methods are not working. So one misapprehension, and this goes back to jargon and what we mean by these words, is that we're also not clear on what age group we're talking to when we're talking about these things. So when somebody says, I was so helped when I was a freshman in college by hearing a sober talk on chastity by a good priest, that does not mean automatically leveraging that into, I will talk about porn and premarital sex to seventh graders. Those are quite different things. So yes, by the time a child goes off to college, they're 18 or so, and they encounter a, you know, probably more or less above board and in-depth talk about chastity, maybe one that goes into more detail, that could be, especially, if you just taking into account what college you're talking about, that context, that I'm not necessarily opposed to that if the mode of talking about it is serious. And if it doesn't involve sacrilege, such as discussing those things in front of the Blessed Sacrament. But talking about those things, that kind of free and frank discussion to a young child is wrong. So what do I recommend? Well, it's hard because it brings us to an even darker situation, which is that the bishops and the clergy have actually abandoned their role of moral formation. So the first thing is, I think we have to speak as much as possible as parents, as members of the church, to our clergy and to our bishops and remind them that They have to talk about the Ten Commandments. They have to speak about the sixth commandment, that adultery is a sin. Adultery means treating someone as a spouse who is not a spouse, and treating a spouse as if he is not a spouse. And speak of the idea of sacrifice, the sacrifice is necessary for family life. The very best communities, the ones out of which came the most vocations and where there was the most faith and the most faithfulness to the church, are the ones where the clergy themselves lived sober lives and austere lives and encouraged the people not to indulge and not to be profligate and to live for their children and to welcome more children, even if it means, yeah, accepting a lower standard of living. A child is worth it. Who in their right mind would not give a sibling to their child? And this is something that John Paul II said, give your child a sibling. Don't worry about vacations. Parents need to be helped to teach their children. John Paul II, through his directive on the sexual education of children, which is something I'll link down in the show notes, said, other educators can assist the parents in the task of teaching their children, especially about sexual matters, but those other educators can only take the place of the parents for serious reasons of physical or moral incapacity. The role of parents in education is of such importance, this is from that document, that it is almost impossible to find an adequate substitute. In fact, he says, that education is the parents' domain insofar as their educational task continues the generation of life. Parents are the first and most important educators of their children. And they also possess a fundamental competency in this area. They are educators because they are parents. What could be more clear than that? He doesn't say, oh, well, parents just don't know what to say. They don't know what to do. They're completely ignorant. They need help from experts. He's saying the opposite of that. He goes on, they share their individual mission with other individuals or institutions such as the church and the state, but the mission of education must always be carried out in accordance with a proper application of the principle of subsidiarity. This implies the legitimacy and indeed the need of giving assistance to the parents, but finds its intrinsic and absolute limit in their prevailing right and their actual capabilities. The principle of subsidiarity is thus at the service of parental love, meeting the good of the family unit, for parents by themselves are not capable of satisfying every requirement of the whole process of raising children. So this is the larger picture, the hierarchy abandoning this teaching, abandoning their traditional role of forming the people so that they can in turn form their children, and abandoning giving them help in that project and instead actively subverting them. This subversion creates a serious problem of Catholic children who have no knowledge of right and wrong, and also, P.S., their parents, and no guidance as to how to act. Then they provide the so-called remedy in the form of chastity ministry to undo by means of a professional class of lay people the very problem they enabled. This is classic rent-seeking. Create a problem and then be there to offer the supposed solution, which only makes things worse. But they do it by proxy, adding another layer of abdication of responsibility. They let experts take over while they do something else. Helping the parents to teach their own children is their primary responsibility. After providing the sacraments and teaching the faith in general. Often that something else is mischief that further undermines the family, such as seeking ways to normalize gender activism, cooperating with feminism, and meddling in politics. To top it all off, parents who try to do who do try to follow the right thing end up having their innocent children confronted by degrading knowledge, all in the name of chastity education. So we parents have to help each other. We have to insist that only the parent is the one to speak to the child. If you see a parent who is not fulfilling his responsibility, help the parent. Seek advice in the confessional and from trusted older people who have fought the fight. Keep all devices away from your children. Everything that would be entailed in doing that will be for their benefit. Forming good friends, forming good partnerships with other parents who believe in the same things. You can do it. It can be done. Don't accept a new vocabulary for discussing these things. The old vocabulary was chosen for a reason, to avoid falling into the very fault that we're trying to correct. A carefully chosen vocabulary that speaks of the marital act and the conjugal union instead of the other vulgar terms that people use sets us apart. It indicates that something important and valuable is being discussed. Understand the developmental stages of the child and what is appropriate for each age. In my sex education article and chapter in my book, I talk about this a lot more. It's not that complicated. When parents have the proper support and are not subverted at every turn, we want to be guided. We are disposed to be compliant, but there is a loss of trust. We have to regain rightful control, even though it's hard and we feel that we just don't have the resources. Until the bishops and our clergy catch up with their real role, which is not to provide programs, but to offer moral teaching to parents and to children at the appropriate time in a limited way, and to guide and help them so that parents can teach their own children organically and by means of the normal events of life together as a family. Nature is a very important part of this. We should all be encouraging each other to be outside, to be in nature, to be with animals in as natural a setting like farm animals, to garden the earth, the flowers. I mean, we are now disposed for, I think ever since I can remember, and probably even in my mother's generation, people laughed at sex education as the birds and the bees. I find that when people are universally laughing at something, sometimes that's your clue that maybe that thing actually has some worth to it. And being out there and observing nature, the birds, observing the bees, observing reproduction out in nature, this is a very important part of the child's development in understanding the role of sex in his nature. Normal family life in the community includes seeing many children be born, seeing many babies nursed at the breast, speaking with delicacy about things, and acting with delicacy and modesty. I realize it's a bit uncomfortable, but I'm convinced we must begin again. Chastity ministry ought not to be a thing. Parents can fulfill this duty. They can help each other when they are helped and guided. In the words of our patron, St. Thomas More, to his daughter, Margaret, "Farewell, my dear child, and pray for me, and I shall for you and all your friends, that we may merrily meet in heaven."
Thank you for joining us for this podcast. This is Phil Lawler speaking for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation, and I hope you'll register on our website to receive information about future events hosted by the Center. If you find these recordings helpful, please help us to continue our work by making a tax-deductible contribution. We cannot continue to provide fine programming without the support of people like you, and we're grateful for your help. To receive updates on our activities or to make a contribution to our work, see our webpage at restorationchristianculture.org. That's all lowercase with no spaces or punctuation, restorationchristianculture.org. Thank you again.